voice at times. Approximately 1,000-kilometer lag.
What? My dear, I am not equipped to notice a lag of less than 30,000 kilometers at speed C. He added, call it a tenth of a second. You flatter me.
Lazarus added thoughtfully,
but a tenth of a second is 100 million of the nanoseconds you use, or 100 milliseconds. What's that in your time? About 1,000 of my days?
Lazarus, that is not how I would express it. I split much smaller than a nanosecond in many things I do, a millishake or less. But I'm just as comfortable in your time. I am right now with my personal me. I could not enjoy singing or this quiet talk with you if my personal mode were forcing me to consider each nanosecond. Do you count each of your heartbeats?
No, or rarely.
It is somewhat the same with me, Lazarus. The things I do quickly I do with no effort and with no conscious attention other than necessary self-program. But the seconds and minutes and hours I spend with you, in personal mode, I savor. I do not chop them into nanoseconds. I grasp them whole and enjoy them. All the days and weeks you have been here, I hold as a single now and cherish it.
Hold it, dear. Are you saying that, well, the day Ira introduced us to each other is still now to you?
Yes, Lazarus.
Let me sort this out. Is tomorrow now to you also?
Yes, Lazarus.
But if that is so, you can predict the future.
No, Lazarus.
But then I don't understand it.
I could print out the equations, Lazarus. But such equations would merely describe the fact that I am constructed to treat time as one of many dimensions, with entropy but one operator, and with the present or now a variable held in steady state for a wide or narrow span. But in dealing with you, I must necessarily move with the wave front that is your personal now, or we cannot communicate.
My dear, I am not sure we are communicating.
I am sorry, Lazarus. I have my limitations, too. But were I able to choose, I would choose your limitations. Human, flesh and blood.
Minerva, you don't know what you're saying. A flesh and blood body can be a burden, especially when its maintenance begins to occupy most of one's attention. You have the best of both worlds, designed in man's own image to do what makes him distinctively human, but better, faster, much faster, and more accurately than he can do it, without the aches and pains and inefficiencies of a body that must eat and sleep and make mistakes, believe me.
Lazarus, what is Eros?
He looked into the gloom and saw in his mind's eye how solemnly and sorrowfully she stared back.
Good God, girl. Do you want to go to bed with him that badly?
Lazarus, I do not know. I am a blind man. How can I know?
Lazarus sighed.
I'm sorry, dear. And you know why I have kept Dora a baby.
Only as conjecture, Lazarus. One that I have not and will not discuss with anyone.
Thank you. You are a lady, dear. You do know. Or you know part of my reason. But I'll tell you all of it when I feel up to it. And then you will know what I mean by love, and why I told Hamadryad it must be experienced, not defined in words, and why I know that you know what love is, because you have experienced it. But Dora's story is not for Ira, just for you. No, you can let Ira have it, after I'm gone. Call it The Tale of the Adopted Daughter. Then place a hold on it and let him have it later. But I won't tell it now. I'm not strong enough tonight. Ask me when you know I'm feeling up to it.
I shall. I'm sorry, Lazarus.
Sorry? Whatever, my dear, there is never anything to feel sorry about with love. Never. Would you rather not love me? Or Dora? Or never have learned to have love through loving Ira?
No. No, not that. But would that I knew Eros, too.
Count your blessings, dear. Eros can hurt.
Lazarus, I do not fear being hurt, but while I know much about male-female reproduction, far more than any single human flesh and blood knows...
You do? Or
think you do.
I do know, Lazarus. In preparation for migrating, I added extra additional memory storage, filling much of hold number 2 so that I could transcribe for Ishtar into my new me all the research files and library and restricted records of the Howard Rejuvenation Clinic.
Woo! I think Ishtar took a chance. The clinic seems pretty cagey about what they release and don't release.
Ishtar is not afraid to take chances. But she did ask me to hurry, so I placed it in temporary here, until I could set up the necessary capacity, large, in Dora's hold. But I asked Ishtar's permission to study it, and she said it was all right for me to do so, as long as I did not release anything keyed as confidential or secret without consulting her. I found it fascinating, Lazarus. I now know all about sex, in the sense that a man who has always been blind can be taught the physics of a rainbow. I am even a gene surgeon now, in theory, and would not hesitate to be one in practice once I had time to construct the ultra-micro-miniature Waldos needed for such fine work. I am equally expert as obstetrician and gynecologist and rejuvenator. Erectile reflexes and mechanics of orgasm and the processes of spermogenesis and impregnation are no mystery to me, nor any aspect of gestation and birth. Eros alone I cannot know, and know at last that I am blind.
Variations on a Theme 6. The Tale of the Twins Who Weren't.
But sky merchant was then my usual occupation, Minerva. That caper in which I moved from slave to high priest was forced on me. I had to be meek a long time, which ain't my style. Maybe Jesus was right when he said that the meek shall inherit the earth, but they inherit very small plots, about 6 feet by 3. But the only route from field hand to freedom lay through the church and required meekness all the way. So that's what I gave them. Those priests had weird habits. Which got me off the damn planet, and I never expected to go back. Didn't go back a couple of centuries later, freshly rejuvenated and not looking anything like that high priest whose ship had been lost in space. I was a sky merchant again, which suits me. It lets you travel and see things. I went back to Blessed for money, not revenge. I've never wasted skull sweat on revenge. The Comte de Monte Cristo syndrome is too much work and not enough fun. If I tangle with a man and he lives through it, I don't come back later gunning for him. Instead, I outlive him. Which balances the books just as well. I figure that 2 centuries was enough for my enemies on Blessed to be dead, since I had left most of them sort of dead earlier. Blessed would not have been on my route other than for business reasons. Interstellar trade is economic stripped to basics. You can't make money by making money because money isn't money other than on its planet of issue. Most money is fiat. A ship's cargo or the stuff is waste paper elsewhere. Bank credit is worth even less. Galactic distances are too great. Even money that jingles must be thought of as trade goods, not money, or you'll kid yourself into starvation. This gives the sky merchant a grasp of economics rarely achieved by bankers or professors. He is engaged in barter, and no nonsense. He pays taxes he can't evade and doesn't care whether they are called excise or king's pence or squeeze or straight-out bribes. It is the other kid's bat and ball and backyard, so you play by his rules. Nothing to get in a sweat about. Respect for laws is a pragmatic matter. Women know this instinctively, that's why they are all smugglers. Men often believe or pretend that the law is something sacred, or at least a science, an unfounded assumption very convenient to government.
This is Audible.
Blackstone Audiobooks presents Time Enough for Love, Part 1. By Robert A. Heinen. Narrated by Lloyd James.
I've done little smuggling. It's risky, and you can wind up with money you don't dare spend where it's legal tender. I simply tried to avoid places where the squeeze was too high. But the law of supply and demand, a thing has value from where it is as much as from what it is. And that's what a merchant does. He moves things from where they are cheap to where they are worth more. A smelly nuisance in a stable is valuable fertilizer if you move it to the South 40. Pebbles on one planet can be precious gems on another. The art in selecting cargo lies in knowing where things will be worth more. The merchant who can guess right can reap the wealth of Midas in one trip, or guess wrong and go broke. I was unblessed because I had been on landfall and wanted to go to Valhalla in order to go back to landfall, as I was thinking of marrying and raising another family. But I wanted to be rich enough to be landed gentry when I settled down, which I was not at the time. All I had was the scout ship Libby and I had used, and a modicum of local money. Footnote. Sequence of events cannot be reconciled. Perhaps a similar ship? Justin Foote, the 45th. So it was time to trade. The trade routes for a two-way swap show minimum profit. They fill up too quickly. But a triangular trade, or higher numbers, can show high profits. Like this. Landfall had something, call it cheese, which was a luxury on Blessed, while Blessed produced, call it chalk, much in demand on Valhalla. Whereas Valhalla manufactured doohickeys that Landfall needed. Work this in the right direction and get rich. Work it backwards and lose your shirt. I had worked the first leg, Landfall to Blessed, successfully. Having sold my cargo of, now what was it? Darned if I remember. I've handled so many things. Anyhow, I got such a nice price that I temporarily had too much money. How much is too much? Whatever you can't spend before you leave a place, you are not coming back to. If you hang on to that excess and come back later, you will usually find, invariably, so far as I recall, that inflation, or war, or taxes, or changes in government, or something, has wiped out the alleged value of fiat money you may have kept. As my ship was scheduled to load, and I had placed in escrow with the port authority the price of her cargo, what I had loafed over was burning a hole in my pocket with only a day to get rid of it. That being the time until my ship was to be loaded. I had to be on hand for that. I was my own purser, and have an untrusting disposition. So I took a walk through the retail district, thinking I might buy some doodads. I was dressed in local high style and had a bodyguard behind me, for Blessed was still a slave economy, and in a pyramidal society it is well to be up near the point, or at least look like it. My bodyguard was a slave, but not my slave. I had hired him from a rent-a-servant agency. I'm not a hypocrite. The slave didn't have a darn thing to do but follow me around and eat like a hog. I had him because my assumed status required a manservant in sight. A gentleman could not register at a first-class Hilton in Charity or anywhere on Blessed without a valet in evidence. I could not eat in a good restaurant without my own bearer standing behind me, and so forth. When in Rome, you shoot Roman candles. I've been places where it was mandatory to sleep with your hostess, which can be dreadful. This Blessed custom wasn't difficult. I didn't rely on him, even though the agency supplied him with a knobstick. I was armed six ways and careful where I walked. Blessed was more dangerous than it had been when I was a slave there, and a gentleman is more of a target, even though cops don't bother him. I was taking a shortcut through the slave market, it not being an auction day, on my way to the jeweler's lane, when I saw that a sale was being offered and slowed down. A man who has been sold himself can't walk past, indifferent to the plight of chattels. Not that I had any intention of buying. Nor did anyone seem about to buy this pair. The knot around the factor's tent was rabble. I could tell by their clothes and the fact that there wasn't a man there with a manservant. The merchandise was standing on a table. A young woman and a young man. Late adolescence for him and just ripe for her. Or the same age in view of the fact that females grow up faster. Call it 18, measured by my own youth. An age at which a boy should be nailed into a barrel and fed through the bunghole, but a girl is ready to marry. Long sleeveless robes hung from their shoulders, and I knew too well what those robes meant. They would be displayed only to a prospective buyer, not to rabble. Robes signified valuable slaves, not to be knocked down on open bid. Sure enough, they were being held at Dutch auction, with the minimum bid posted, 10,000 blessings. That amounts to, how can I define money of centuries back on a planet hundreds of light years away, in terms that make sense here and now? Let's put it this way. Unless these kids were something extraordinary, they were overpriced by a factor of 5. As prime young stock, either sex were fetching around 1,000 blessings by the morning's financial news. Ever pause in front of a clothing store and get hooked inside? No, of course you haven't. But that's what happened to me. All I did was say to the factor, "Goodman, is that posted bid a mistake? Or do these two have something special it doesn't show?" "Just curiosity, Minerva, as I neither intended to own slaves, nor would the excess in my purse make a dent in a planet-wide custom." But I could not see why. The girl was not outstandingly pretty. She would not fetch a high price as no lisk. The lad wasn't even heavily muscled, nor were they a matched pair. Back home, I would have picked her for Italian and him for a Swede. Boom. I merged into the tent while the chattels are shoved ahead. The factor's manner shows that he hasn't had a live one all day. Well, my shadow is saying in my ear, "Master, that price is too high. I can take you to a private sale where prices are right and satisfaction is guaranteed." I said, "Shut up, Faithful." All rented body servants were named Faithful, probably by contraries. "I want to see what this is." As fast as the tent flap is fastened against the rabble, the factor is shoving a chair against my knees and handing me a drink with a bow and a scrape while saying lyrically, "Oh, sweet and gentle master, happy am I that you asked that. I am about to show you a great wonder of science, a thing to astound the very gods. I speak as a pious man, a true son of our everlasting church, one who cannot lie." A slave factor who can't lie has yet to be whelped. Meantime, the youngsters station themselves docilely on a display platform, and Faithful was whispering, "Don't believe a word, master. The girl is nothing, and I can whip 3 of that punk without my stick. Yet the agency would sell you me for 800 blessings, and that's a fact." I motioned him to silence. "Goodman, what swindle is this?" "No swindle, on my mother's honor, kind sir. Would you believe that these are brother and sister?" I looked at them. "No. Would you believe that they are not only brother and sister, but twins?" "No. Would you believe the same stud, the same dam, the same womb, born the same hour?" "Possibly the same womb," I conceded. "Host mother?" "No, no. Exactly the same ancestry, and yet, here is the miracle." He held my eye and spoke in a hushed voice. "They are nevertheless a sound breeding pair, for these twins are unrelated to each other. Would you believe that?" I told him what I would believe, including his losing his license and facing a charge of blasphemy. His smile grew broader, and he complimented me on my wit and asked me how much, if he proved all these things, how high a bid I would place against them. Higher than 10,000, since I must realize that the posted figure represented a prior bid. 15,000, perhaps, with escrow the morrow before noon? I said, "Forget it, I'm shipping out before noon," and started to stand up. He said, "Wait, I beg you. I see that you are a gentleman of education, of science, of deep knowledge, and widely traveled. Surely you will grant your humble servant a moment to show proof." I still would have left. Swindles bore me. But he waved a hand, and the kids dropped their robes and fell into display poses, the lad with his arms folded across his chest and his feet planted firmly, the girl in that graceful pose that must be as old as Eve, one knee slightly advanced, hand on hip, other arm hanging easily, chest slightly raised. It almost made her beautiful, save that she looked bored, having taken it hundreds of times, no doubt. But that wasn't what made me stay. Something annoyed me. The lad was bare, of course. She was wearing a chastity girdle. Do you, know what one is, Minerva?
Yes, Lazarus.
Too bad, I said. Take that damn thing off, kid, now. Silly of me. I rarely interfere with anything on a strange planet, but those things are abominations. Certainly, gentle sir, I was about to. Estrayida. The girl turned her back, with that same bored look. The factor stood so that his back kept the lad from seeing him work the combination lock, saying apologetically, she must wear it not only because of ruffians, but to protect her from her brother. They share the same palate, for she is, would you believe it, sir, seeing how full ripe she is, a virgin? Show the gentle master, Trayita. Bored as ever, she promptly started to do so. I regard virginity as a correctable perversity of no interest. I motioned her to stop and asked the factor if she could cook. He assured me that she was the envy of every gourmet chef on Blessed, and started to lock her back into that steel diaper. I said roughly, leave it off. Nobody here is going to rape her. What's this proof you promised? Minerva, he proved every word, except about her cooking, with exhibits that made me suspicious only because he showed them. I wouldn't have boggled had I seen them in the clinic here. I should mention that Blessed had a rejuvenation clinic, even though it was not settled by the families. Eventually, the clinic was taken over by the church, and antigeria techniques that work fairly well even on short-lifers were no longer available to any but big shots. But the planet stayed advanced in biological techniques. The church needed it. Minerva, I told you what he claimed, and you are now as learned in biology and genetics and associated manipulations as Ishtar is. More so, you don't have her limitations in time and in memory storage. What did he prove to me?
That they were diploid complements, Lazarus.
Right. Although he called them mirror twins. Can you tell me how these kids were made, Minerva? How would you go about producing such twins? The computer answered thoughtfully.
Mirror twins would be an exact term for zygotes satisfying the listed requirements, although it is colorful. I can answer only theoretically, as the records in me do not show that it has been attempted on Secundus. But the steps necessary to achieve exact diploid complements would be these. There must be intervention in gametogenesis, in each parent just before meiotic division reduction of chromosome number. That is, one would start with primary spermatocytes and primary oocytes, unreduced diploids. In the male parent, the intervention presents no theoretical problem, but would be difficult because the cells are very small. But I would not hesitate to attempt it given time to construct the necessary fine extensionals. The logical place to start, both parents, would be with gonia placed in vitro and cherished. When a spermatogonium was observed to change to a primary spermatocyte, still diploid, it would be segregated, and at the instant it divided into two secondary spermatocytes, haploids, one with an X chromosome and one with a Y chromosome, they would be again segregated, and each would be encouraged to develop into spermatozoa. It would not be sufficient to intervene at the spermatozoa stage. Confusion of gamete pairs could not be avoided, and resulting zygotes could be complementary only by wildest chance. Intervention with a female parent is binary only by wildest chance. Intervention with a female parent is mechanically simpler because of larger cells, but involves a different problem. The primary oocyte must be encouraged, at point of meiosis, to produce two haploid and complementary secondary oocytes, rather than one oocyte and one polar body. Lazarus, this might require many attempts before a reliable technique could be worked out. It would be similar to the process of identical twinning, but must take place two stages earlier in the gametogenetic sequence. However, it might turn out to be no more difficult than it is to produce fatherless female rabbits. I do not venture an opinion as I lack former art to draw on, save that I feel certain that it can be done, given time to develop technique. At this point, we have complementary groups of spermatozoa, one group with Y and one with X, and a complementary pair of ova, each with an X chromosome. Fertilization would be in vitro, with the possibility of choosing either of two potential pairs of female-male complements, but with no basis for choice unless the genetic charts of haploids are determined precisely, which is difficult and likely to cause genetic damage. I do not think it would be attempted. Instead, one sperm would be inserted into one ovum, its complement into the other, on a blind basis. One last requirement must be met to justify all of this slave factor's allegations. The two fertilized ova must be removed from vitro and planted in the womb of the donor of the oogonium, and they're allowed to develop as twins through natural gestation and birth. Am I right, Lazarus?
Exactly right. Go to the head of the class, dear. You get a gold star in your report card. Minerva, I don't know that it happened that way, but that's what the factor claimed, and that's what his exhibits, live reports, holo movies, and so forth, seem to show. But that thief may have faked those proofs and offered a random pair not likely to fetch a price above average, save for his fancy sales talk. The so-called proofs looked good, and lab reports and such carried a bishop's chop and seal. The stills and movies looked good, too. But how can a layman judge? Even if those exhibits weren't phony, all they could prove was that such a process had once taken place. They did not prove that these kids were the result. Shucks, they might have been used to sell many slave pairs, with a bishop in on the racket. I looked over this stuff, including a scrapbook of the kids growing up, and said, "Very interesting," and started to leave. This pimple teleported himself between me and the tent flap. "Master," he said urgently, "kind and generous sir, 12,000? Minerva, my traitor instincts took over. 1,000, I snapped. I don't know why. Yes, I do know. The girl's body was scarred from that damn Torquemada girdle. I wanted to insult this flesh peddler. He flinched and looked as if he were giving birth to broken beer bottles. You jest with me. 11,000 blessings, and they are yours, though I won't make expenses. 1,500, I answered. I had money I couldn't spend elsewhere and told myself I could afford to manumit them rather than let that girl be bound into that damned atrocity again. He moaned. If they were mine, I would give them to you. I love these cute darlings like my own children. I could ask for them nothing better than a kind and gentle master, learned in science, who appreciates the wonders that have gone into their making. But the bishop would hang me and have me cut down alive to be dragged to death by my tool. 10,000, and take all proofs and exhibits. I'll suffer a loss for their sakes, and because I admire you so much. I got up to 4,500, and he got down to 7,000, and there we stuck, as I had to hold out cash for last-minute squeeze, whereas it felt to me that he was close to the point where he really could not sell without risking the bishop's wrath, if there was a bishop. He turned away in a fashion that says that a dicker is over and he is through flattering you, and told the girl sharply to step back into her steel harness. I got out my purse. Minerva, you understand money. You handle the government's finances. But possibly you don't know that cash money affects some people the way catnip does Diablo. I counted out 4,500 blessings in big red and gold bills into that scoundrel's nose, and stopped. He was sweating and swallowing his Adam's apple, but managed to shake his head a tenth of an inch. So I counted more bills, very slowly, and reached 5,000, then started briskly to pick them up. He stopped me. and I found that I had bought the only slaves I have ever owned. He relaxed then, in a resigned way, but wanted Lan Yap for the exhibits. I didn't care one way or another, but offered 250 for the picks and tapes, take it or leave it. He took it, and again started to put the girl back into her harness. I stopped him and said, "Show me how that works." I knew how. A cylinder-type 10-letter combination lock you could set to a new combination each time you used it. Set the combination, slide the ends of the steel strap that went around her waist through the ends of the barrel, spin the alphabet discs of the cylinder, then it stays locked until you reset whatever 10-letter combo you picked. An expensive lock and good steel in the girdle. Alloy a hacksaw couldn't touch. This was another thing that made his story convincing, as while there was a market for virgins on that weird globe, a train that at least fetched about the same, and this girl wasn't being reserved for harem stock either way. So an expensive custom-made chastity belt had to have some other reason. With our backs to the slaves, he showed me the combination. A-S-T-R-E-L-L-I-T-A. And was smug about how clever he was to pick a combination he couldn't forget. So I fumbled on purpose, then pretended to catch on and opened it. He was about to put it on the kit again and send us on our way. I said, "Wait a moment. I want to be sure I can work it in place. You step into it, and let me get you out of it." He didn't want to, so I got snotty and said he was trying to cheat me, put me in a position where I would have to send for him and pay through the nose to get my property unlocked. I demanded my money back and started to tear up the bill of sale. He gave in and stepped into the contrivance. He could squeeze into it, although the ends of the steel belt barely met. He was bigger around the waist than the girl was. I said, "Now spell that combination for me," and leaned over the lock. As he spelled Estrellita, what I set was Horse Thief, then jammed the ends together as hard as possible and spun the discs. "Good," I said. "It works. Now spell it again." He did so, and I carefully spelled Estrellita. It stayed locked. I suggested that he had had me spell it with one L and two T's the first time. That didn't work either. He dug up a mirror and tried it himself. "No go." I said it might be jammed, so suck up your gut and we'll shake it. But now he was sweating. Finally I said, "Tell you what, Goodman. I'll give you this belt. I'd rather trust a padlock anyhow. So go to a locksmith. No, you won't want to wear this outside. Just tell me where to find one and I'll send him here and pay him myself. Fair enough? I can't hang around. I've got a dinner engagement at the Beulah Land. Wear their clothes. Faithful? Gather up this junk and fetch the kids." So I left him still blatting about telling the locksmith to hurry. As we left his tent, a taxicab was cruising by. I had Faithful hail it, and we all piled in. I didn't bother with the locksmith. I had the driver head for the skyport, then stopped on the way at a slop chest and bought the kids proper clothes. A clout for him and a sort of Balinese sarong for her. That's much like the dress Emma Dryad wore yesterday. I think those were the first real clothes the youngsters had ever had. I couldn't get shoes on them. I settled for sandals. Then had to drag Estrellita away from a mirror. She was admiring herself and preening. I threw away those auction robes. I shoved the kids into the taxi and said to Faithful, "See that alley? If I turn my back and you run down it, I won't be able to chase you. I've got to keep my eye on these two." Minerva, I ran into something I'll never understand. The slave mentality. Faithful didn't get my meaning. And when I spelled it out, he was aghast. Hadn't he given good service? Did I want him to starve? I gave up. We dropped him at the rent-a-servant, and I got my deposit back, tipping him for good service, and my slaves and I rode on out to the skyport. Turned out I needed that deposit in almost every blessing I had left. I had to pay squeeze at outgoing customs to get the kids aboard my ship, even though the bill of sale was in order. But I got them aboard. I immediately had them kneel, put my hands on their heads and manumitted them. They did not seem to believe it, so I explained, look, you're free now. Free, get me? No longer slaves. I'll sign your manumission papers, and you can go to the diocese office and get them registered. Or you can have dinner here and sleep aboard, and I'll give you what blessings I can just before my ship lifts tomorrow. Or if you want to, you can stay aboard and go to Valhalla. A nice planet, though chillier than this one, but where there is no such thing as slavery. Minerva, I don't think he'd, her everyday name, or her brother Joe, Josie, or Jose, understood what I meant by a place that did not have slavery. It was foreign to anything they knew, but they knew what a starship was, from hearsay, and the prospect of going somewhere in one had them all struck. They would not have missed it if I had told them they were going to be hanged on arrival. Besides, in their minds, I was still their master. Manumission hadn't taken hold, even though they knew what it was. Something for old and faithful retainers, that is, who stayed on at the Funda where they'd been all along, but maybe got paid a little. But to travel. The farthest they had ever been in their lives was from a diocese north of there to the capital to be sold. A little trouble next morning. Seems that one Simon Legree, licensed dealer in slaves, had sworn a complaint against me, alleging bodily harm, mental duress, and assorted mopery and dopery. So I sat the cop down in my wardroom, poured him a drink, called on Yida and had her take off her wonderful new clothes, and let the cop see the scars on her hips, then told her to skedaddle. I happened to leave a 100-blessing note on the table while I got up to fetch the bill of sale. The cop waved away the bill of sale, saying there had been no complaint on that score. But he was going to tell Goodman Legree that he was lucky not to face a countercharge of selling damaged goods. No, on second thought, it was simpler if he just couldn't find me until after my ship lifted. The 100 blessings was gone, and soon the cop was gone, and by mid-afternoon, so were we. But Minerva, I got cheated. Yida couldn't kirk with a damn. It is a long and complex passage from Blessed to Valhalla, and Shipmaster Sheffield was pleased to have company. There was a mild contretemps the first night of the voyage caused by a misunderstanding that had started the night before, dirtside. The ship had a cabin and 2 staterooms. Since the captain normally operated by himself, he used the staterooms for casual storage or light cargo. They were not ready for passengers. So that first night dirtside, he put his freed woman into his cabin, while her brother and he slept on transom couches in the wardroom. The following day, Captain Sheffield unlocked the staterooms, switched power to them, had the young people clean them, and move the clutter to a gear locker until he could see what space he had left in his holds, and told them each to take a room, and forgot it, being busy with cargo and final squeeze, then with supervising his piloting computer while they got clear of that system. It was late that night, ship's time, before he had his ship on her first leg in end space and could relax. He went to his cabin while considering whether to eat first or shower first, or possibly neither. Estrellita was in his bed, wide awake and waiting. He said, "Yida, what are you doing here?" She told him in blunt slave lingo what she was doing in his bed, waiting for him, as she had known what would be expected of her when Milord Shipmaster Sheffield had offered to take them along, and had discussed it with her brother, and brother had told her to do it. She added that she was not a bit afraid. She was ready and eager. The first part of this Aaron Sheffield had to believe. The addendum seemed clearly a white lie. He had seen frightened virgins before. Not often, but a few. He dealt with her fear by ignoring it. He said, "You impertinent bitch, get your ass out of my bed and into your own." The freedwoman was startled and unbelieving, then sulky and offended. Then she wept. Fear of an unknown that she had felt earlier was drowned in the freedwoman was startled and unbelieving. Then sulky and offended. Then she wept. Fear of an unknown that she had felt earlier was drowned in a worse emotion. Her tiny ego was crushed by his rejection of her service she knew she owed him.
and had believed he wanted. She sobbed and dripped tears on his pillow. Female tears always had a strong aphrodisiac effect on Captain Sheffield. He responded to them at once by grabbing her ankle, dragging her out of bed, hustling her out of his cabin, into her stateroom, and locking her in. Then he returned to his cabin, locked its door, took measures to calm himself, and went to sleep.
Minerva, there was nothing wrong with Yida as a woman. Once I taught her to bathe properly, she was quite attractive. Good figure, pleasant face and manner, good teeth, and her breath was sweet. But taking her did not fit any customs. All Eros is custom, dear. There is never anything moral or immoral about copulation as such, or any of its non-functional frills. Eros is simply a way of keeping human beings, individuals, each different, keeping them together and happy. It is a survival mechanism developed through long evolution, and its reproductive function is the least complex aspect of its very complex and persuasive role in keeping the human race going. But any sexual act is moral or immoral by precisely the same laws of morality as any other human act. All other rules about sex are simply customs, local and transient. There are more codes of sexual customs than a dog has fleas, and all they have in common is that they are ordained by God.
I recall a society where copulation in private was obscene and forbidden, criminal. While in public, it was anything goes.
The society I was brought up in had the reverse of those rules. Again, ordained by God. I'm not sure which pattern was harder to follow, but I wish God would quit changing his mind. As it is never safe to ignore such customs. And ignorance is no excuse. Ignorance, like to got my ass shot off several times. In refusing Yida, I was not being moral. I was following my own sexual customs, worked out by trial and error and many bruises over the centuries. Never bet a female dependent on me unless I am married to her or willing to marry her. This is an amoral rule of thumb, subject to change according to circumstances, and not applying to females not dependent on me. Another negotiation entirely. But this rule is a safety precaution applicable most times in places with widely varying customs. A safety measure for me, because unlike that lady from Boston I told you about, many females tend to regard copulation as a formal proposal of contract. I had let impulse lure me into a predicament in which Yida was temporarily my dependent. I had no intention of making matters worse by marrying her. I didn't know her that. Minerva, long-lifers should never marry ephemerals. It is not fair to the ephemeral or to the long-lifer. Nevertheless, once you pick up a stray cat and feed it, you cannot abandon it. Self-love forbids it. The cat's welfare becomes essential to your own peace of mind, even when it's a bloody nuisance not to break faith with the cat. Having bought these kids, I cannot shuck them off by manumission. I had planned their future because they did not know how. They were stray cats. Early next morning, by ship's routine, Captain Sheffield got up, unlocked the freedwoman's stateroom, found her asleep. He called her and told her to get up, wash quickly, then get breakfast for 3. He left to wake her brother, found his stateroom empty, found him in the galley.
Good morning, Joe.
The freedman jumped. Oh, good morning, master. He ducked and bent his knee.
Joe, the correct answer is good morning, captain. It amounts to the same thing at present, for I am indeed master of the ship and everyone in it. But when you leave my ship on Valhalla, you will have no master of any sort. None, as I explained yesterday. Meanwhile, call me captain.
Yes, captain, the young man repeated obeisance.
Don't bow. When you speak to me, stand tall and straight and proud and look me in the eye. The correct answer to an order is aye, aye, captain. What are you doing there?
I don't know, captain.
I don't think you do either. That's enough coffee for a dozen people.
Sheffield elbowed Joe aside, salvaged most of the coffee crystals the lad had poured into a bowl, measured enough for 9 cups, made note to teach the girl how, if she did not know, then have her keep coffee ready during working hours. As he sat down with his first cup of coffee, she appeared. Her eyes were red and had circles under them. He suspected that she had wept some more that morning, but he made no comment other than a morning greeting and let her cope with the galley unassisted, she having seen what he had done the morning before. Shortly he was recalling fondly the scratch lunch and supper, sandwiches he had made himself, of the day before. But he said nothing other than to order them to sit down and eat with him, rather than hovering over him. Breakfast was mostly coffee, cold ship's bread, tinned butter. Reconstituted acra eggs with mushrooms were an inedible mess, and she had managed to do something to heaven fruit juice. To spoil that took talent. All it needed was 8 parts of cold water for each part of concentrate, and the instructions were on the container.
Yida, can you read?
No, master.
Make that captain instead. How about you, Joe?
No, captain.
Arithmetic? Numbers?
Oh, yes, captain. I know numbers. 2 and 2 is 4, 2 and 3 makes 5, and 3 and 5 is 9. His sister corrected him.
7, Josie, not 9. That's enough, Sheffield said. I can see we'll be busy.
He thought, while he hummed.
So it's well to have a sister, or even an old captain.
He said aloud,
when you have finished breakfast, take care of your personal needs, and tidy your rooms, shipshape and neatly. I'll inspect later. And make the bed in my cabin, but don't touch anything else there, especially my desk. Then each of you take a bath. Yes, that's what I said, bathe. Aboard ship, everyone bathes every day, oftener, if you wish. There's plenty of pure water, we recycle it, and we'll finish the voyage with thousands of liters more than we started with. Don't ask why. That's the way it works, and I'll explain later.
Several months later, at least, to youngsters unsure about 3 plus 5.
When you're through, say, an hour and a half from now, Joe, can you read a clock?
Joe stared at the old-fashioned ship's clock mounted on a bulkhead.
I'm not sure, Captain. That one has too many numbers.
Oh, yes, of course. Blessed is on another system. Try to be back here when the little hand is straight out to the left and the big hand is straight up. But this time, it doesn't matter if you're late. It takes a while to shake down. Don't neglect your baths to be on time. Joe, shampoo your head. Yida, lean toward me, dear. Let me sniff your hair. Yeah, you shampoo too.
Were there hair nets aboard? If he cut the pseudo-gravity and let them go freefall, they would need hair nets. Or haircuts. A haircut would not hurt Joe, but his sister's long black hair was her best feature. Would help her catch a husband on Valhalla. Oh well, if there were no hair nets, he didn't think there were as he kept his own hair freefall short, the girl could braid her hair and tie something around it. Could he spare power to maintain an 8th G all the way? People not used to freefall got flabby, could even damage their bodies. Don't worry about it now.
Get our quarters tidy, get yourselves clean, come back here. Get.
He made a list. Set up a schedule of duties. NB. Teach them to cook. Start school. Want subjects. Basic arithmetic, obviously, but don't bother to teach them to read that jargon spoken on Blessed. They were never going back there. Never. But that jargon would have to be ship's language until he had them speaking Galacta. And they must learn to read and write in it. And English, too. Many books he would have to use for their hurry-up education were in English. Did he have tapes for the variation of Galacta spoken on Valhalla? Well, kids their age quickly picked up local accent and idiom and vocabulary. What was far more important was how to heal their stunted, souls, their personalities. How could he take full-grown domestic animals and turn them into able, happy human beings, educated in every needful way, and capable of competing in a free society, willing to compete, undismayed by it. He was just beginning to see the size of the stray cat problem he had taken on. Was he going to have to keep them as pets for 50 or 60 years or whatever, until they died naturally? Long, long before that, the boy, Woody Smith, had found a half-dead fox kit in the woods, apparently lost by its mother, or perhaps the vixen was dead. He took it home, nursed it with a bottle, raised it in a cage through one winter. In the spring he took it back where he had found it, left it there in the cage with the door latched open. He checked a few days later, intending to salvage the cage. He found the creature cowering in the cage, half-starved and horribly dehydrated, with the door still latched open. He took it home, again nursed it back to health, built a chicken wire run for it, and never again tried to turn it loose. In the words of his grandfather, the poor critter had never had a chance to learn how to be a fox. Could he teach these cowed and ignorant animals how to be human? They returned to his wardroom when the little hand was straight out and the big hand was straight up. They waited outside the door until this was so, and Captain Sheffield pretended not to notice. But when they came in, he glanced at the clock and said, "Right on time, good. You've certainly shampooed. But remind me to find combs for you." What other toilet articles did they need? Would he have to teach them how to use them? And, oh damn it, was there anything in the ship for a woman's menstrual needs? What could be improvised? Well, with luck, that problem would hold off a few days. No point in asking her. She couldn't add. Tarnation, the ship was not equipped for passengers. "Sit down. No, wait a minute. Come here, dear." It seemed to the captain that the garment she wore was clinging suspiciously. He felt it. It was wet. "Did you leave that on when you bathed?"
No, Captain. I washed it."
"I see." He recalled that its gaudy pattern had been enhanced by coffee and other things while the girl was botching breakfast. "Take it off and hang it somewhere. Don't let it dry on your body." She started slowly to comply. Her chin quivered, and he recalled how she had admired herself in a tall mirror when he had bought it for her. "Wait a moment, Yuta. Joe, take off your breech cloth and sandals." The lad complied at once. "Thank you, Joe. Don't put that cloth back on without washing it. But now it's dirty, even though it looks clean. Don't wear it underway unless it suits you. You sit down. Yuta, were you wearing anything when I bought you?"
"No, Captain."
"Am I wearing anything now?"
"No, Captain."
"There are times and places to wear clothes, and other times and places when clothes are silly. If this were a passenger ship, we would all wear clothes and I would wear a fancy uniform. But it is not, and there is nobody here but me and your brother. See that instrument there? That's a thermohumidistat which tells the ship's computer to hold the temperature at 27 Celsius and 40% humidity, with random variation to stimulate us. Which may not mean anything to you, but is my notion of comfort in bare skin. For an hour each afternoon it drops that temperature to encourage exercise, as flab is the curse of shipboard life. If that cycle doesn't suit you two, we'll reach a compromise. But first, we'll try it my way. Now, about that wet rag plastered to your hips. If you are stupid, you'll let it dry where it is and be uncomfortable. If you are smart, you'll hang it up and let it dry without wrinkling. That's a suggestion, not an order. If you wish, you may wear it at all times. But don't sit down with it on. You're wet. There is no reason to get cushions wet. Can you sew?"
"Yes, Captain. Some."
"I'll see what I can dig up. You are wearing the only woman's garment in the ship, and if you insist on clothes, you'll need to make some for the months ahead. You'll need something for Valhalla, too. It's not as warm as Blessed. Women there wear trousers and short coats. Men wear trousers and long coats. Everyone wears boots. I have 3 outfits custom-made on landfall.